everyone. This morning I'm distributing these appeals for our Sangam Hall. If you haven't received one, you please take one. And if anybody will see the hall, the construction, Helmut would take you there after the class. We are on page 643 at the break. 643 at the break. Last week we read the first two sections of this canto, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real, which ends with these lines we just heard the mother reading. And we looked in detail at the first section, which gives a description of that world, the dream twilight of the earthly real, in which death shows to Savitri a symbolic representation of the earthly life, the reality of the earthly life. And now he's going to continue with his discouraging arguments, his attempts to make Savitri give up her will to carry living Satyavan back to the earth. So today we'll read this way. You begin, please, Margaret.
Once more arose the great destroying voice across the fruitless labor of the worlds, his huge denials, all defeating mind, pursued the ignorant march of dolorous time. Behold the figures of this rainbow realm, its solid outlines of creative dream, inspiring the great concrete task of earth. In its motion parallel of human life, here thou canst trace the outcome nature gives to the sin of being and the error in things, and the desire that compels to live, and man's incurable malady of hope.
Thank you. This is the voice of death, the great destroying voice. Even the sound of this voice is destructive. If anyone likes to sit on the floor, there are a couple of cushions also. We're on page 643 at the break. In this part of the poem, Sri Aurobindo is showing us a long colloquy, a conversation between Savitri and the god of death. Death has taken the soul of Savitri's husband, Satyavan, and he is leading him away, and Savitri is following. She is determined to take her husband living back to earth. So we have been following for several weeks this conversation. And just now, when we started, Margaret read these lines from line 83 to line 94. After the break on page 643. It describes how death once more is sending out his great destroying voice, his huge denial, his power that destroys everything, and it seems to be following the ignorant march of dolorous time, painful, suffering human time. And he tells Savitri, look, see this world. We saw the world described in the first section, which we read last week. He says, here, this is a parable, a moving parable, a story with a meaning. This is the parable of human life. And here in this world, in this symbol world, you can see the outcome, the results that nature gives to the sin of being. According to him, the very fact of existing, of living, is a sin against the eternal order of things, of nothingness, which he claims to represent. The error in things. You will be able to see all that. You will be able to see the desire that compels things to live. He's following the doctrine that desire is the force that creates the world that we live in, and that the only thing to do is to escape from that. Man's incurable malady of hope, this terrible, incurable sickness which keeps human beings continuing to live because of their hopes. He mocks and derides all these things. We'll read on from there, page 95. Leila?
In an immutable order's hierarchy where nature changes not, man cannot change. Ever he obeys her fixed mutation's law. In a new version of her oft-told tale, in ever-wheeling cycles turns the race. His mind is spent in circling boundaries. Though mind is man, beyond thought he cannot soar. If he could leave his limits, he would be safe. He sees but cannot mount to his greater heavens. Even winged, he sinks back to his native soil. He is a captive in his net of mind, and beats soul wings against the walls of life.
Thank you. So this is another doctrine of death, that nature is fixed and does not change. There's an immutable order, a hierarchy which doesn't change. Nature doesn't change, so man too cannot change. Human beings have to obey this fixed law of nature, which does allow for some mutation, but then the same things come back again and again. What we experience whenever we think we're experiencing something fresh and new, it's just a new version of her same oft-told tale. She's told it very often, again and again. The race, the human race, is just turning and turning in ever-wheeling cycles. Everything comes back again and again. The mind of man is pent, closed up, confined, encircling boundaries. The boundaries go round and round, but they are always there. And mind is man. He cannot reach any higher than mind. So we know very well that this is not what Sri Aurobindo tells us, but this is what death is telling to Savitri. If man could leave his limits, if he could get out beyond these boundaries, he would be safe. But he looks up, he sees the possibility of greater heavens, but he can't get there. Even when he's got wings, wings of aspiration and will, he can go to a certain height, but then he has to sink back onto the soil, the earthly foundation that he was born on. He's like a bird which has been caught in a net. He's a captive in his net of mind. Maybe he does have a soul, a winged soul like a bird, but even that soul is constricted. It's caught in this net of mind, struggling like a little bird who's caught in a net, this net of life. Audrey, would you read?
In vain his heart lifts up its yearning prayer, peopling with brilliant gauze the harmless worry. Then, disappointed, to the void he turns, and in its happy nothingness asks release, the calm nirvana of his dream of self. The word in silence ends, in naught living. A part amid the mortal multitudes, he calls the Godhead in commute kibble, to be the lover of his lonely soul, or cast his spirit into its void embrace. Or he finds his copy in the impartial whole. He imparts to the immobile his own will, attributes to the eternal wrath and love, and to the ineffable lends a thousand names.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about these lines?
The quibbling is bread and goats. It's as if goats were the fruit of the imagination of man.
Yes. Mm. Yes. We catch or we envision greater possible states, no? And there's some prayer or aspiration rises up, but those brilliant gods we imagine, they are only imaginations in this formless emptiness. And when we find that those brilliant gods don't answer our prayers, eventually we think, oh, it would be very peaceful. It would be a great release to dissolve into that emptiness. We ask for release in that happy nothingness. We think of that as a very desirable state, the calm nirvana in which our dream of self can be dissolved. And all the word that has given rise to all this creation ends in silence. The name, whatever sacred name we have been relying on, it ends in nothingness. Yes, that's another way of envisaging the universal spirit. We think there's this all which is the universe. There must be some kind of spirit which upholds it, and that spirit doesn't have any preferences. It upholds everything. All the things that happen in the universe, no? So, one thing that we human beings may do, we may envisage an individual Godhead that we adore and devote ourselves to and rely on, no? And we want to be embraced by that Godhead that we imagine. Or we may not do that. We may think of what is divine as this impartial, universal force, the impartial all. I don't know whether we would say it is an absolute reality, but at least a universal reality, no? And he thinks, oh, that impartial all must be like me, no? So then we impart to the immobile, that impartial all doesn't move at all, but we think that it has a will in the way that we have a will. And we imagine that this eternal, infinite, impartial being feels anger and love in the same way that we do.
Because we are partial.
Because we are partial. And to the ineffable, to that reality which about which nothing can be expressed really, he gives it 1,000 different names. The names of imagined brilliant gods and godheads. Jocelyn. I think we'll pause there. I'm not sure whether this is the longest sentence in the poem, but it's one of the longest sentences in the poem. It may be the longest one. There are some very long sentences like this. But let's go back to the beginning of it, read it quietly for ourselves, and then we'll look line by line at it. So the first few lines are clear, no? He's telling her, hope not to call God down into man's life. No? How are you going to do it? How are you going to bring the everlasting into this earthly reality? There's no room for him, no house for him, in hurrying time, in this passage of time. And you are quite deluded in seeking for any kind of aim or purpose in the world of matter. The material world doesn't have an aim or purpose. No aim is there. There's only some kind of blind will to be, to exist. And in this world, all beings, all creatures walk according to the laws of nature, bound, ever the same. There's no possibility of change.
When he says that ever the same, he refuses the evolution.
Well, he says there's mutation, There's an appearance of change, but then there's just a recurrence of the same cycle over and over again. But no aim, no purpose. Of course, there are many materialists who believe this, no? That it's nonsense to think about any aim or purpose in the material world, in the material universe. How can there be? So then he says, look what I'm showing you in this world. Look on these forms. They're all transient. They stay a while and then they pass. And then he gives this long list of things that stay a while and pass. First of all, the lives, our own lives, that are full of longing and struggle, quite dramatic. It feels very important to us, but then it's all gone, no? These structures, all the different structures that human beings build up, but they have no abiding truth, no permanent significance. Look, there have been so many savior creeds, religious, spiritual systems that claim to offer a solution, no? But they are not able to save themselves. No? They too perish after some time in the strangling hands of the years. Time destroys them. They get discarded from man's thought. Time proves that they are false. They're not only religions, these are also structures, no? But there are philosophies that have claimed, or maybe they do in a way, strip all problems bare. They reveal the substance of them. But doesn't matter how revealing they are, they have never solved anything since the world began. Another structure is the currently very powerful structure of the sciences, which seems to be omnipotent, all-powerful. But what good does it do them? It's in vain. Men have learned to find out what the suns are made of, all the distant stars. They can tell you what are the composition of them. We're able to transform all forms to serve our outward needs through science and technology. We can ride through the sky, sail beneath the sea in submarines, but we haven't learned, and science cannot tell us what we are and why we are here. And then these polities, these social systems of organization, they are architectures of man's brain. They are built of these bricks of morality, bricks of evil and good. And they actually wall in our free spirit, no? But these structures are all fissured houses. They have cracks in the walls. They may look like palaces, but at the same time, they are prisons. No? They will rot. They will crumble before they crash and fall. No? That's where we stopped, I think. No? Oh, no, revolutions. Yeah. So in the train of these polities, there come revolutions. We try something new, but these are very violent times of the demon or drunken god. They convulse the poor, wounded body of humankind. And what do they do in the end? They just paint that same old face with new colors, with new makeup. Yes. Polities. Polity is a way of organizing a polis, a society. So there are different ways of doing that. No, in our lifetimes we have seen Stalinism, and we have seen Nazism, and we've seen socialism and democracy at the moment. Although we know democracy is so flawed, that's the kind of polity that seems to be the most promising. And here in Oroville we are trying to find a completely new kind of polity that would be based on soul values. No? But so far, all the polities have been architectures of man's brain, ways of thinking about things and saying it would be good to organize our society. And politics is the way of getting your polity implemented. So, Helmut, would you read on in this long list?
These walls, carnage triumphant, ruin gone mad, the work of centuries vanishing in an hour, the blood of the vanquished and the victor's crown, which men to be born must pay for with their pain, the hero's face divine on satire's knees, the demon's grandeur mixed with the demigods, the glory and the beasthood and the shame. Why is it all the labor and the din, the transient joys, the timeless sea of tears, the longing and the holding and the cry, the battle, the victory and the fall, the aimless journey that can never pause, the waking story, the incoherent scene, song, shouts and weeping, wisdom and idle words, the laughter of man, the irony of the gods. Where leads the march? Whither the pilgrimage? Who keeps the map of the week or plant each stage?
Thank you. It's very poignant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything?
Why is it all?
Yes, what is it all for? He says there's no aim. We take all these things so seriously. What is it all for?
In this passage of that, I feel sort of interest, like when he gets a kind of look, he's like that. I can't find it when he said, man, be careful.
But death is just saying all this to discourage Savitri and to discourage us.
Yeah.
No? And he finds his discouragement reflected in our consciousnesses. We can identify with what he is saying.
Sometimes
truth, sometimes false.
Yeah,
mixed.
Mixing.
Yes.
I'm still puzzling about Hamlet and one about the mind, because every time in everything we are reading,
yes,
this doctrine is there, for mind is man. So it reduces everything all the time. Okay, there's still mind. And then I remembered a very famous Dutch professor, and he wrote a book, We Are Our Mind. And it's popular all over the world. And we accept this idea, this doctrine.
So that's why when we came to this line, I said, this is not Sri Aurobindo's view. No? This is not.
The mindset about time.
We are mental beings. That is our position in the evolutionary movement. We represent the emergence of mind. But the second part of the sentence is not true. It is not true that we cannot go beyond mind. We are not only mind. We are also soul and spirit. So we are not forever confined within the limits of mind. Sri Aurobindo wouldn't want us to believe that.
Yeah.
but he did agree that it, up to a certain level, the mind helps. You get all the physical and vital.
Yes, no doubt. It is at the moment, the reason is the highest light that has been developed evolutionarily. No?
But it's our mindset today that we are only mind.
That, yes, we. That's the doctrine that we have been taught for the last 400-500 years. No? In India, it is still not so all-pervasive. Yes, that's right. Yes. He means, when he says mind, he means our surface mentality.
Who's engaged in past and future only all the time?
The plan. Yeah.
By the past or planning for the future?
Yes. Yes.
It's only there.
And of course, in a way, it's true that humanity is, at the moment we look at it, it is trapped in this pattern, and all these things that he's listing are the result of that. I remember when I first, the very first time that I heard about Sri Aurobindo's vision, without even having heard his name, what I heard and what caught me immediately was that all the problems that humanity, we see ourselves facing, are the result of the fact that we are at this particular stage of evolution. And here, at this stage of evolution, our mind cannot solve these problems. All the solutions just produce more problems. So what is the solution? The solution is to evolve further, and from a higher level be able to look down on all this, and from there to be able to do something to set it right. That's why I'm sitting here today, because somebody said that in a basement flat in London 50 years ago.
Intuition, that's beyond mind.
Well, no, what Tuan says is right. Sri Aurobindo identifies various levels of mind. Well, that's what we've been reading in The Life Divine, no? But he does say, in exactly in what we've been reading, that the highest level of mind that has been so far evolved in humanity is spiritual mind, spiritualized mind. But above that, he recognizes these other levels: higher mind, illumined mind, intuition, revelation, overmind, and then other gradations leading to supermind. And in what we've been reading in The Life Divine, he tells us that although each of these new levels is transformative, it's based on knowledge, and can transform the whole nature, individual nature, the complete transformation can only come about when there's a descent of supermind. And that is why Sri Aurobindo and the mother dedicated their lives to bringing about that step, because only the supermind has the power to really convert the dragon of the dark foundations, who's living in that cave of the inconscience and sitting on all the divine treasures. I have an image of this dragon sitting on my table in front of Mother's picture. And this morning she showed me, look at this dragon. There he is, he's sitting on all the treasures. But look, in his hand he has a huge pearl. He's offering it to her. That's the great change that has come about.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks to them.
Yeah.
Just a minute, Tara was asking something.
Yeah. phase we are in is the mind development. Like, just a lot of people want proof of it, and other people feel inside to go with it or have faith or believe it or.
Yes.
But a lot of us don't have direct experience of it.
Yes.
So I feel sometimes it's, in the end, this is just the way it goes, and to be. It's also no use to be condescending on people who don't
yes.
always believe.
How can they? And how important this level of rationalization and democratization and all liberalization, how important that has been to the evolutionary process.
You can't convince people to believe.
No. But if by grace you get some kind of message and your soul receives it and accepts, what a blessing. What a blessing. Yes, and that's a huge change that has come about in humanity in my lifetime. If I think about the mindset into which I grew up as a teenager and in which I received this message, how much has changed over the last 50 years? No? Yeah. So we can hope for even greater change. No? Where were we? Yes, or else self-moved. Then he drops all that and he starts on another possibility. Would you like to read, lady at the back in the green dress, would you like to read? Thank you. Perhaps there's nothing there but mind. Perhaps everything is only a figment of our minds, no? Or the mind, universal mind, we could say. It's dreaming. This world is a myth that just by chance happened to come true. A legend told to itself by conscious mind. And it's imaged and played out on this ground of matter, a feigned matter's ground. This matter itself is an illusion of our minds. So here mind is standing on this base that isn't really there. It stands here. In an unsubstantial vastness. So whatever we experience, mind is the author, spectator, actor, stage. Mind only is, and what it thinks is seen. So if it's like that, and death is saying it is like that, if mind is everything, then forget about bliss. Renounce the hope of bliss. Renounce the hope of truth. For mind can never touch the body of truth. And mind can never see the soul of God. Only it grasps hold of a shadow. And we don't hear God laughing at us when we turn away from the shadow to this vain seeming, this unsubstantial seeming of things. Yes.
Here the mind is always with capital M.
Yes. That's why I think it doesn't mean individual mind, it means the universal mind, plane of mind. Yes, that is what Tuan was saying, no? That he's not thinking about the higher possibilities of mind, which Savitri will point out to him later on. He's only thinking about our normal human mind, which is obsessed with the sense impressions, and its highest light is reason, and even that higher light of reason, we limit it, tie it down, to accept the evidence of the senses.
I'm wondering to what extent death is trying another tactic of Savitri in listing the things that she is hoping for. And I'm wondering how I do that myself in my life, that something comes up and says, oh no, this is not going to be possible. It seems she's saying that there is truth, there is hope, there is bliss, there is joy.
She's not only saying it, the difference between Savitri and us is that she knows it. She has had the experience. So all this nonsense that death is telling her, to her it is absolutely unconvincing. And that's why she's always able to answer him. She's not discouraged in the least. But why is Sri Aurobindo putting this in the poem? We've talked about this before. Why is he putting this long debate there? It's because this voice of death is our mind. And this is the mind that is telling us the truth that slays, which destroys hope and faith, exactly what Tara was saying. And what Savitri is answering to these arguments that are so prevalent and so convincing to us is the truth that saves. So that's why we should pay much more attention to what she says than to what death says, except that we should recognize in what death says that it's what our own mind and the mind of other society that we live in is usually telling us. Exactly as Patricia said, you think of doing something and then you say, oh no, that won't work. But if you have enough faith and enough determination, it will work for sure. But do you want it enough? No? Are you going to be able to hold on to that vision long enough? Is it what you really want? Is it what your soul wants?
I think when he uses this word or and if, so a lot of it is hinting the possibilities of the human mind to grow beyond it. Mind can never see the soul of God. So there is a hindrance there. One has to move and grow out of that.
Yes. Well, it's interesting that he mentions the soul of God, no? The materialistic mind wouldn't even think of mentioning that. No? So, who is this figure of death? Who is this who is testing all the realizations that Savitri has had in the course of her yoga tapasya? We shall see when we come to book 11.
Savitri's mother, the queen, when Savitri chooses Satyavan, that time also she has dialogues with Savitri, and somehow she also tries to...
She's very realistic. Well, she's a mother, she's a human mother, and she says everything that a human mother should say, good advice to her daughter, no? And then we see in Canto 2 of Book 6, then we see the protest of the mother's voice to to Narad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how can it be like this? No? What is wrong with the world and why is it? Mm? And that gives, of course, Sri Aurobindo another opportunity to give certain answers through Narad, to prepare us for the profounder answers that Savitri herself will give us here in this canto. Yes, Don?
Again, isn't it perhaps also true that as mankind is trying to overcome ignorance and gain more and more knowledge, that it's right now at this level, it's only two is mind. So mind isn't a bad thing, but makes many, many, many mistakes and so on. Yet searching, 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 what else can we search for?
The mind should ideally be at the service of the soul. At the service of the soul.
The mind is not bad. Not depicted as bad.
Mm. Yes.
Not
mind.
Being used.
Mm. It's not being used, right? Yeah.
In the right way. It's not bad at all.
Why did Sri Aurobindo write all these books which are addressed to the mind? No? I mean, I'm not meaning particularly this one. Of course, our mind helps us to follow and understand this. But in this book, Sri Aurobindo is actually speaking directly to our soul through our vital capacities, our life capacities of aesthetic enjoyment. But it's the soul that can recognize the truth of what he says. And receive the power.
This whole discussion with death, it's strengthening the will, power of savagery all the time.
Yes.
There is this dialogue with death.
Yes.
You see, you're aware of strengthening the will.
Yes. And I'm sure, I haven't yet had the time to try to do it, but I'm quite sure that somehow in the course of books 9 and 10, we could exactly find the correspondences with the course of her yoga, the experiences that she has, the entry into the inner countries. There she has to deal with the subtle physical. Therefore, the first time she learns to exteriorize herself from the body. She couldn't be having this colloquy with death if she hadn't managed to leave her body there on the forest floor and follow him into the subtle worlds. So I think step by step, all these realizations are being put into practice. So a realization is one thing, but to the implementation, the transformation in every part of the being, that is, Sri Aurobindo himself has said, that can take decades after the realization. He said, in his case, decades. Shall we go on? Yeah.
Mind is a tissue woven of light and shade, where right and wrong have soon their mingled parts. For mind is nature's marriage in Venus, between truth and falsehood, between joy and pain. This striving pair knows hope and separate. Each thought is a gold coin with light alone, and error and truth are its outwards and reverse. This is imperial mintage of the brain, and of this kind is all its currency. Feign not to plant on earth the living truth, or make of matter's world the home of God. Truth comes not then, but only the thought of truth. God is not there, but only the name of God.
Mm.
said there is, it is bodiless and unborn. It is no one, and it is possessed by none. On what shalt thou then build thy happy world? Cast off thy life and mine, then art thou self, an all-seeing, omnipresent star, and all.
Thank you. Anything to ask or share about these lines?
Just a question of misprint?
Convenance.
Yeah.
We are used to the phrase a marriage of convenience. Mm-hmm. No?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to this question. I was just thinking that most of this book has been dictated, but some parts of it were written earlier, and one would have to ask Richard Hartz, who has looked at all the manuscripts, to be sure about this word.
Is confidence not agreement?
I'm not familiar with this word. Has Rand Hicks said anything about it? A covenant is an agreement. A covenant.
In French,
yes. Yes.
Exactly this expression. In French, mariage de convenance.
It's convenance, it's French. Yes, so that's Sri Aurobindo's taken the French word. Yes, sir. Yeah, it's a bit difficult when everybody starts talking separately, but anyway, I'm trying to hear you, sir. Yes. You wanted me to speak about these lines about the self. Yes. If self there is, it is bodiless and unborn. It is no one, and it is possessed by none. This is an evocation of the self, the one self of of the one. Well, with death we are never sure, but anyway, I think any spiritually advanced person might give a similar thing, that the self is one. It does isn't confined to any particular form or body. It is unborn in the sense that it's not subject to birth and death. It is no one particular individual, and it can't be held or possessed by any particular individual. This is, of course, not the whole truth about the self, because none of us would have individual selves if the self were not all-pervasive and all-supporting. Yeah. Thank you. So, thank you very much, Jean-Yves. This is the Mariage de Convenance. This is French. So, as in Rand Hicks.
Covenant is here, covenant isn't, but I'm sure it's fairly much the same. A mutual agreement or compact reached between two or more parties.
That's a covenant. That's a covenant.
That's a covenant, that's the actual thing. Covenants would be.
But did you hear what Jean-Yves said? He said, in French, the phrase for a marriage of convenience is a
mariage de convenance. It's convenient for both
parties.
But the root, etymologically, in English, you don't have this, but you have convenient.
Yes.
It's the same.
That is why. That is why we tend to read it as a marriage of convenience. But that's not what he's written. And he must have had his reasons for using the French word. And it's not a mistake, it's correct in French.
But it means the same.
The meaning is
these two things.
A marriage of convenience is usually supposed to be a marriage which is taken purely for financial reasons. There's no love or anything like that. It's just convenient to have a link between two particular families. That is so.
But here it could also be a marriage of agreement between.
Yeah.
Here it says it's a marriage of convenance
truth
between truth and falsehood. Mm-hmm. These two things, and he says nobody can separate them. This struggling pair, they are not happy to be together, but nobody can divorce them, nobody can separate them. Because, of course, they are two aspects of the same thing.
In the Bible it says in many places...
A covenant.
The Israelites making a covenant with God.
Yes, this is...
What is the relationship with that covenant, that word?
I think it's a different word. A covenant is... In the Bible, it means the promise that God has made to the Jews after the flood, when the flood subsided, and then he said to Noah, I won't do anything like this again. I'm putting the rainbow in the sky as the symbol of our agreement. And then with Christ, we talk about the new covenant. It's a new promise or a new arrangement with God, between God and humanity.
So that helps me to understand the French word. No. Is not, this word is not the same as what you just said.
Actually, if we look at the Latin roots, convenance, it means coming together.
Exactly.
Yeah?
For
whatever
reason. Shall we go on? So he's continuing his wise advice to Savitri. Larry, would you read?
If God there is, he cares not for the world. All things he sees with calm and different gaze. He has doomed all hearts to sorrow and desire. He has bound all life with his implacable laws. He answers not the ignorant voice of prayer. Eternal, while the ages toil beneath, unmoved, untouched by aught that he has made, he sees as minute details with the stars, the animals' agony, and the fate of man. Immeasurably wise, he exceeds thy thought. His solitary joy needs not thy love. His truth in human thinking cannot dwell. If thou desirest truth, then still thy mind forever.
Thank you. When he says to Savitri, cast off thy life and mind, then art thou self. He's again calling on her, as one solution, to dissolve her own individuality. And of course, this is a piece of spiritual advice that has been given over and over again. But it is not Sri Aurobindo's view. He sees the individual as the instrument of evolution. Even we were reading in Life Divine last week, last Wednesday. The individual is the first instrument and the field for the descent of the supermind. So Sri Aurobindo advises us to treasure our hard-won individuality. How difficult it has been for individuality to develop in the course of evolution. And it's not meant to be just dissolved and thrown away for the sake of peace and calm and silence. If we want to participate in this forward march of evolution, then the individuality is something extremely precious, and we can hope to become more and more individual. We're not going to achieve human unity by becoming all the same. We have to, each of us, to realize all the unique potentialities that we are carrying within ourselves. Aught. A-U-G-H.
A-R-T.
Thou art.
A-R-T.
Thou art means you are. Thou is the tu form. In French, in English, it is thou. But we don't use it in English. We don't use that second person singular form. Tu es. Thou art. Is it clear? Yes. You are. Yeah. Then you will be yourself. Yeah. Yes, Margaret.
Recently, I had a meditation and a question comes up. What does it mean to be one all? And several times. And then the mother gave me a vision that we are, every individual is in this bubble, a transparent bubble, like I think pretty Gauche painted it also. And in this one, we keep the individuality and we are together.
Yes, that's it. It's something like that. Yes. And these individualities are growing and developing, becoming more and more infinite. But at the end, he tells her, if thou desirest truth, then still thy mind, make it absolutely calm and quiet forever, slain, destroyed by the dumb, unseen light. Slain means killed, destroyed. So Savitri has done this. She has done this. So she has seen the truth and realized the truth. She's realized the truth of individuality, of oneness, of one in all. So she's not affected by these things. So
but
we
not
also
by dumb light, but the conscious light. Here he says dumb light.
He says the dumb light, the light that can't express itself, that doesn't express itself. Perhaps he means his particular darkness. He may mean that. Yeah. I think we'll stop there for today, unless anybody has anything pressing they want to ask. Yes, John? Yes, that's what I thought Mariage was asking. This is the opposite of naught. Naught means not ought, not anything.
This is anything.
Anything or something. No? Yeah. Sorry, what were you saying, Narendra?
Dictionary says anything about ought.
Yes, it's anything. Yes. Yes.
My question is based on the last question also. Here, while he says mind, capital M, and light, capital L, but actually, Swarovinda has put it capital, but it means what death means also as mask, wider mind, wider light, but it is not the real.
No, what we have to do is distinguish between what Sri Aurobindo is saying and what death is saying. And when Sri Aurobindo, when we are distinguishing that, we should remember that we can't be absolutely sure anywhere in after the end of book three that Sri Aurobindo really intended a capital or what he meant by it. Because after that it was mostly done by dictation. And he may have dictated a capital, but he may also not have. And that certain changes have been made in this edition, that even the editors say they can't be 100% sure that the corrections are correct.
We have to read them with reference to context.
We have to try and understand what is being said and what might be the reason. We can't do more than that. Yes. Sorry?
You said after Canto, which Canto?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean Canto. After the end of book three, I think Niroda says he took up the work of a scribe, perhaps in book 5 or 6. But I think the revision from the beginning of book 4 was done entirely without Sri Aurobindo being able to read the text. If I'm right, I mean, you can check this out yourselves also. Yeah. Shall we leave it there for today? We'll listen to Mother reading a couple of passages from the beginning of this canto. And then, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm distributing this information about our Sangam Hall. And if anybody would like to go after the class to see Helmut, as the architect would guide you, you can go afterwards and have a look.
Is 40 lakhs will be enough for all the work which you are planning?
40 lakhs is what we think we need to complete the hall and the multimedia facility structurally. Still be another amount needed to get all the equipment. But we'll face that when we come to it. All right, yes, start the 1 and 2. 1 and 2 at least. Let me have a look. Yeah, we can do 3.
Once more, arose the great destroying voice. Behold the figures of this symbol ring. Its solid outlines of creative dreams, inspiring the great concrete stars of earth. Where nature changes not, man cannot change. Hope not to call God down into his life. How shalt thou bring the everlasting here? There is no house for him. In hurrying time. But Savitri answered to the sophist God, if the chamber's door is even a little ajar, what then can hinder God from stealing in? Or who forbid his kiss on the sleeping soul? Already God is near, the truth is close. Alone freedom cannot satisfy a heart that has grown one with every heart. I am a deputy of the aspiring world. My spirit's liberty I ask for all. Then bang again a deeper cry of death. Mighty art thou, with the dread goddess filled, to whom thou criest at dawn in the dim wood. Use not thy strength like the wild titan soul. Touch not the seated lines, the ancient laws, restrict the calm of great establishing. But Savitri replied to the huge God, what is the calm I withdraw.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.